I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. I really enjoyed reading the new book by Philip Seagram, No Judgment and Other Busking Stories. In the book, he chronicles leaving his job as a judge to hit the road going across Canada busking. This is in 2022, just as we're coming out of the pandemic. He's able to see the country in his travels in a unique way, seeing divisions over politics and vaccines. As he plays, he's got his guitar case open, and people are allowed to leave money or take money. Anything extra is donated to Ukrainian humanitarian relief. I'll ask Philip about the experience of meeting a variety of people on the street and why people donated or why they took money. Philip Seagram is a former criminal lawyer and provincial court judge who has lived and worked in Vancouver's downtown east side, the Okanagan, Similkameen, and the West Kootenay. He is a late-blooming singer-songwriter, writer, and cross-country ski instructor. He lives with his wife, two horses, a dog, and a cat on a small acreage near Nelson, B.C., though he joined me from Victoria just over 3 weeks ago. The website for more is at philipseagram.com. This new book is published by Caitlin Press. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Philip Seagram. Mr. Seagram, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How long were you a judge for?
I was a judge for 5.5 years.
And before that, what field of law did you practice?
I was practicing as a criminal lawyer, and I mostly as a prosecutor. Most of my career was with the Crown, but I also worked for a while as a defense lawyer.
And you mentioned in the book that you'd worked part of your career here in Vancouver, is that right?
That's right. I articled in Vancouver. I had my first real job as a lawyer with the Crown in the Fraser Valley. And I worked as a defense counsel in the downtown east side, where I started off living in Vancouver.
How long have you lived in Nelson?
Boy, I've lived in Nelson now for 25 years.
I see. Yeah. Have you always played music?
No.
And so
no, I've always listened to music, but no, I'm definitely a late bloomer as a musician.
And I think I read this in the book. You'll correct me if I'm wrong. You turned to music as a way to, say, relax or get away from the work, I guess. Because being a judge, being a lawyer, that can be pretty intense, pretty busy and the sort. Did you find music as a great respite from the work you were doing, say, professionally?
Yeah, I really did. It was actually my wife who pulled me into it. Maybe about a dozen years ago, I was, now I think of it, I've actually been in Nelson only 20 years, but about 12 years ago, my wife was in a community choir, and she kept telling me that they needed some male voices in the choir, and she dragged me out to a choir session, and I ended up really liking it. And when the choir disbanded, I just kept on singing with a number of people, 3 or 4 people, and then eventually we formed a little band, and I realized I better learn how to play an instrument if we were going to carry on, and it just kind of went from there. But yeah, it was a huge, although it was my wife that got me into it, and maybe she had, she had the belief that I needed it.
Mm-hmm.
It was, a nice way of helping me balance things out from the work.
So it's one thing, to join a choir, do it on, say, weekends and evenings, or a band, say, weekends and evenings. It's another thing to busk, and I find it interesting how you come to that. And the other thing I found interesting is that you've never found performing easy, had you?
No, and I still don't. I still I feel nervous before every show, and I found that, when our band broke up and I was starting to play on my own, that was like a qualitative difference between playing with other people. When you're up there performing on your own, it's much more nerve-wracking to me.
And does busking, did you think that it would be a great way to, say, get your legs in terms of performing, as opposed to, say, if you worked as a solo artist at an open mic or something like that?
Yeah, I think that was part of it. I mean, I was curious about what it would be like, you know, I've always paid attention to buskers. I've always admired buskers. And I thought that busking would be a great way to kind of force myself out there and play a lot, especially if I was playing day after day in different places. I thought it would just be a great way of just relaxing a bit. And, you know, it's also a great way to see a place. It's a really kind of interesting vantage on a city to play on a sidewalk and watch people go by and talk to those people. It's not like visiting a city as a tourist. You kind of become, you know, a little part of it for a while.
So it's one thing to say busk, you know, outside the courthouse there in Nelson or somewhere downtown. It's another thing to see the country as you have. Was that part of the, I mean, when did you decide that you were going to, say, go across the country doing this?
You know, after I gave my notice to leave judging, you know, I began to sort of think about having some sort of an adventure after my last day of judging. And, you know, people were making suggestions to me about things I could do. And I knew I wanted some kind of adventure that was different, that was going to be hard and challenging. And I wanted to get away from Nelson, I guess. I mean, I'd been there because of the pandemic. I really hadn't gone very far in the previous 2 years. So I came up with busking, I think, because it was a way of, you know, going from place to place without just feeling like a tourist and wandering around. It would offer a challenge to me because I'd never busked before. And, you know, I had to sort of figure out how I was going to make my way as I went. So, you know, there was a whole bunch of different reasons for coming up with busking. I don't like feeling like a tourist, and I thought that busking on a city street would be a really interesting way to travel across the country.
And you meet all sorts of people doing this, don't you? I mean, you meet the people that have lived in a particular city for a very long time, who don't get to go, you know, go to different cities. You meet young people, business people, people who are just walking across the street, all walks of life. It's just a fascinating way to see the country too, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. And I guess when I started out, I was kind of curious about what it would be like, particularly in the wake of the pandemic, as the country was, and the world was just kind of emerging from that. I always tried to find a location that was really busy with a lot of people walking by and as broad a cross-section of people as I could find. And one of the things I learned early on was that buskers are seen, at least, as being very approachable. And so people would want to talk.
And the other thing that I just found fascinating as I was reading the book is that you are seen different ways, too. And I mean, you do feel that, don't you, how people view a busker. I mean, we like to think that we don't judge people, but I suppose people that saw you on the street with your guitar and your sign, even if they didn't see your sign, they already assumed what sort of life you've had or the circumstances with which you've ended up there, right? I mean, they tend to think that you're doing that for a living, if you will, or trying to you know, make money for the day.
I think that's a natural assumption. I think all of us have that. I certainly did. But you know, the people that I don't really know what was in people's minds. I know that a lot of people would just walk by and ignore you. They wouldn't even look at you. They might sneak a glance at your sign, but they kind of ignore you. And other people, you know, would see you. They'd meet your eyes. They'd give you a smile. They'd give you a thumbs up. They might stick around for a while. They might give you some money. You know, there were people that took money as well from the case, from my guitar case, which was, you know, part of the idea behind it. And so I think there's a whole variety of ways that we see people, and that I guess that includes buskers. I see buskers as I guess now I see buskers as you know, having all kinds of different stories and all kinds of different backgrounds, and some of them are just phenomenal musicians you know, rely on the income that they make from busking to make their way.
Yeah, I'd say that reflects more on me, I guess, because even before I read the book, I always thought that buskers did it because they were looking to subsist on whatever they were given by passersby. Until I read your book, I guess, you know, that's a great way to say, hone your craft, especially in the daytime, say if you're working gigs at night even, to work as a musician during the day. I mean, you know, you've got a captive audience, if you will. It's a great way to do it, right?
Musicians practice a lot, and what a great way to practice, you know, to get out of your little cell and get out on the street. And it's very liberating, too, to play to... It's not really an audience. You're just sort of playing and seeing what happens. So you've got, you know, you don't have an obligation. Nobody's paying you anything to play. It's just a great place to be to practice. And also, as I said, to have this really nice kind of vantage point on what's going on out on the street.
You mentioned your sign a moment ago. For people listening to us, you wrote on your sign that you invited people to give, but you also invited people to take, which I don't think a lot of us have seen. Say, I mean, I've never seen that before here in Vancouver. In terms of the people that did take, did you ever think about what they would do with the money? Or your mind does wander a bit in terms of the reasons why people would need. I mean, we all know why people would need money, but I mean. Did you think about that as you were playing, as you were watching people, say, grab something out of the guitar case?
Yeah, I did. And some people would tell me, I think as a means of, you know, trying to explain and maybe justify what they were doing, or they just felt a need to say, here's why I need it. But others didn't. I was surprised at how specific people were. They would, and how they would really honor the intent of the sign. Most of them, almost all of them, would ask, you know, can I really take some money, or does this sign mean what I think it does?
Yeah.
And I would clarify, and they would say, you know, oh, I could, you know, I really need $4, or I need $2, or I need more. And I never really would comment on that. I would just say, you know, take what you need. And that was the whole idea. There was an element of trust there, kind of going both ways. I think the people that took money would have to trust that, you know, I'm not offering any judgment on them because they're taking money. And at the same time, I'm trusting them to take what they need and not more than they need. There were a few times where, I did wonder where the money was going to go. There's one story in the book in particular called, the titular story. It's the story called No Judgment, where I had some misgivings about what was happening to the money.
Yeah, I don't want to give it away, but that's you do write about what you were thinking about, and even the food left, the taste left the food that you were eating, because you were thinking about the reasons why this one person, I guess they didn't have front teeth, why they took what they did and what they did with the money afterwards, right?
Right. Yeah.
Did you ever get cleaned out? Say, you know, like kids or something like that, just see the sign and take advantage of it.
I don't know if that they took advantage of it. I mean, I really tried hard not to look behind, you know, why somebody was taking the money and just, you know, maintain that trust. I did get cleaned out. There were people who would come and take everything that was in the case, or maybe just leave a few coins behind. But, you know, I really didn't ever have that much money in the case.
Uh-huh.
There may be $30, $40 in the case at a time. And it wasn't a huge deal. And, you know, in the grand scheme of things, $30, $40 really isn't that much.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Definitely that happened a few times.
And I do recall that at the end of this all, you came away with about $2,000, is that right?
Yeah, all in kind of quarters and toonies and loonies, and it was all changed. There were some people who left bills,
yeah.
And that all went to the Ukrainian humanitarian relief fund that the Red Cross had set up.
Yeah, so this is 2022, thereabouts, where the Russian invasion had happened, and you wrote on the sign that the money would go to Ukrainian relief, right?
Right.
Yeah. There was that moment in Calgary where the lady gives you $50, a $50 bill.
Right.
And she says, I can't remember what she says now, but she says not to put it in the case, and she gives it to you directly. Was that because she didn't want anybody else to take the money, do you think?
I think what that meant is that she wanted to, bypass the give or take part of the sign, and just she wanted it to go directly to the Ukraine humanitarian aspect.
Yeah.
She was sort of looking around, and she held out her hand, and she said, "Put this away, put this away." And so that's the way I took it. There was another instance. I didn't write about it in the book, where this fellow came up to me and he said, "I want to give you $20, but I want it to be for you.
Mm.
You know, I want to give you $20, and I don't want it to go into the case for anybody else to take. I just want it to go to you." And I said, "Well, you can do that, but you have to understand that if you give me the $20, I can do whatever I want with it. And if I want, once it's given to me, I can put it in the case, or I can give it to Ukraine Relief, or I can do, or I can, you know, go out and buy a burger, right?"
Yeah.
And he said, "Yeah, once it's yours, it's yours." So with that understanding, I accepted his $20 bill.
Yeah. I guess it's like when you go to a restaurant and you know, you tip on the machine, but you want to give the person cleaning the table or you know, the wait staff that waited on you the money directly. You know.
Yeah. I understand that. But I think also, you know, there may have been a bit of that, you know, really not knowing my background, but actually thinking that I could use it, or maybe just wanting to show some kind of personal appreciation for what I was doing, just liking the whole idea of the enterprise and wanting to, you know, give me some reward for setting up this dynamic.
There are a number of people that you encounter that you write about in the book that really are looking for somebody to talk to, and it shows just how hard it is to make a connection in our society, sometimes a behavior can put people off, and that's why they don't, you know, they just walk by the person, you know, who's you know, on the street and you know, looking to talk to somebody or wanting to be seen. And that's in every city you encounter that sort of situation, right?
Yeah, it happened a lot, and I think part of that was because of the locations I chose.
Mm-hmm.
I chose downtown locations where, as I said, there was, you know, the broadest cross-section of people I could find. And there are people on the street who really don't have much to do during the day. And so, you know, they would hang around. And I think, as I said earlier, I think buskers are really approachable. They're very non-threatening. And particularly buskers who are singing, I think putting your voice out there is a pretty vulnerable thing to do. And so I think the music and singing, I was singing original songs. I was singing songs that I had written, maybe one or two cover songs, but they were all my own, basically all my own songs. So you have this kind of older guy out there singing folk songs and doing his best. And so I guess I was pretty approachable, and but I guess was seen as somebody that would be easy to talk to. So in between songs or as I was taking a break, people would come up and talk, and sometimes they would talk, turn into long conversations, and sometimes just short ones. But there was that, yeah, I guess that opportunity for some connection that people wanted.
So you left Nelson, and then you started in Victoria, and then you went across the country. This all done in one big trip, say?
It was. Yeah. It was 8 weeks. When I was in Toronto, my mother lives there, and I visited with her for a couple of days, had a hot shower and some food, and busked in Toronto. When I got to Halifax, I busked in Halifax, and then my brother lives out in Nova Scotia, and I spent a couple of days with him, and then headed back. There were a couple of short little stops along the way where I'd spend 2 or 3 days in a city to see someone I knew there, basically family members, and then I'd carry on. I knew I had to get it done in 2 months because I had other things happening back in Nelson.
You mentioned your wife a moment ago. What did she make of say, you being away for 2 months?
You know, I think by the time I went, I talked about it enough, and I put all this effort into creating this beautiful sign. I think she knew it was something that I really had to do, and my wife has been incredibly supportive, not just throughout my professional career, but with anything else I got really interested in, and the music is something that she has really, really supported. So, and I think she knew, you know, it was difficult to leave a career like that, and I think she probably appreciated that. Getting that kind of a break, getting some time by myself and having an adventure by myself, though it would be difficult for me and for her, it was something I really needed to do. So she was wonderful about it.
Do you wish you did this when you were younger?
Oh, I wish I'd done a lot of things when I was younger. I wish I'd started playing guitar when I was 15, you know, I'd be a much better guitarist right now. I guess I'm just glad I had the opportunity to do it. But yeah, I wish I'd started the music thing and, you know, been able to be a better musician by now than I am. That would have been great.
So it did really, the thing that they say that it's all practice, isn't it? Whether it's being a singer or playing an instrument, the more you do it, the better you get, right?
Yeah, you definitely have to put in the hours. I was listening to, I can't remember his name, but the guitarist for Rush being interviewed the other day on the radio, and, you know, that guy's still practicing 6 hours a day.
Mm.
He probably doesn't need to, but he loves it, and, you need the hours. I think before I, you know, really started to get into music, I thought it was kind of like riding a bike. You learn your craft, you learn how to play piano, and then that's it. It's always with you, but really good musicians, they're practicing all the time. They're practicing every day.
Do you play every day?
I do. I travel with my guitar. I play a little bit of, you know, other instruments, banjo and ukulele, and I play harmonica a bit. But I really want to get good on guitar, and I enjoy it. And I'm a songwriter, and sometimes you get songs just by accident because you're just picking up your guitar and playing whatever comes into your head, and you find something that you like, and now you've got the germ of a song. So I try to take advantage of, you know, those kind of serendipitous moments where you just discover something. So, yeah, I play every day.
I guess a great lesson that I got out of the book, Philip, is that how we go about our day, or how we should go into the world every day and how we interact with people. If we're a little more conscious of other people in our society, or kinder to the people we encounter, it'd be a better world, wouldn't it?
It absolutely would. Just that really basic fundamental level. And I think that everyone has become more isolated over the last few decades, in part, not despite the internet, but because of the internet. I think there's a lot of isolation out there. I think there's a lot of lonely people. And, you know, the cure for that and the cure for understanding people is to know and to not be afraid of people, is to actually know other people and know people that are different from you or in different situations than you. And you can only know them if there's some point of connection, if there's some way of talking with them and having the time to just have a conversation, learn about them, tell them about yourself.
You know, I was just thinking as I was starting the book, and because I've reached you in Victoria today, you mentioned in the book that Victoria, it's not a place that you could go to and say, just put your guitar case down and start playing on the street. You have to get a license. I think it's the same in Vancouver too. It's quite prescriptive, isn't it?
Yeah, Victoria, you absolutely have to have a license, and then even then you're not. I think they have special permits for the really prime busking area along the harbor front. Vancouver, there are places you can busk without a permit, but there are zones where you must have a permit. As far as I can remember, that's the way it is.
So in other cities across the country, did you encounter sort of these rules and law bylaws, if you will?
Yes. I don't think I researched every city. I tried to. I knew I had to have a permit for Toronto. In Montreal, you didn't have to pay for a permit. They had, but I knew I wanted to try busking in the metro, in the subway system in Montreal, and they have a system where you have to register in this kind of online program and book spots on the metro system. They have these designated spots where buskers play, and they're strategically placed and spaced out. And you book these two-hour time slots online, and then you just show up at these spots, and it's yours for those 2 hours. But they're all different. All the cities are completely different. There's some cities where there's no busking bylaws whatsoever. There's rules about whether you can have amplification, you know, or whether you can't. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier with amplification, I think, to get heard. But, yeah, they're all different. Cities are more welcoming than others.
Yeah, I don't know if I made this up in my head, but I seem to recall in Vancouver, because I've lived in Vancouver my whole life, that there was a moment where in the SkyTrain stations, or the big station downtown Waterfront, that TransLink was holding auditions, and then I tried to look it up online, and I didn't get very far, and so I just gave up. But I seem to recall that was one of the things that one needed to do to say play in a spot like that.
Yeah, they do that in Toronto because
those spots
are really in the subway. They're very coveted, and there are people that, you know, they make a good chunk of their living there, and they have phenomenal musicians playing because they are auditioned, and they have this show that you can go to. You can actually watch the auditions at the Canadian National Exhibition in summer when they audition for the permits for the next year. You can sit and watch some amazing musicians basically competing for their permits and to play in the subway for the next year.
So you're playing every day. Are you writing every day as well?
I'm not. Certainly not writing music every day. I'm trying to, you know, become a disciplined writer. This book is my first book. I mean, I've been writing legal material for decades, but this is my first actual book of prose, and I'm really keen to do more. So I'm trying to become a disciplined writer and develop that practice of writing something every day. It's hard, but I'm getting better.
This is such a great book. It's a beautiful book in many places. I can't tell you how much I enjoyed it, and how it got me thinking about a number of things, not just in whatever cities we live in, but, you know, in life itself. Congratulations on it, and continued good luck with it. I so appreciate your time today, Philip.
Well, I really appreciate your interest, Joe, and the interview. It was good to do. Thank you.
The website for more is at philipsegrim.com. The book is called No Judgment and Other Busking Stories. It's published by Caitlin Press. Its author, Philip Segrim, joined me on the line from Victoria in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.